I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
If country borders and grids can fascinate you, and state names intrigue you, if atlases, globes, city plans, subway maps, and of course, world maps are your thing, if you can name the capital city of Namibia, and if you get giddy about flags, you are in the right place. This is Map Corner, a podcast about the love of maps brought to you by Royfield Brown and Claire Asprey. Now, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to Map Corner. I'm Royfield Brown, who is 52 degrees, 28.46 degrees north, and 1 degree, 54.09 degrees west, which puts me in Birmingham. Oi,
you're not paying attention,
are you, Asprey?
Well,
we are, but you're not actually even paying attention. I can hear you like flicking through your atlases or something. You know, listen, paying attention.
I was looking through your notebook to see if I'd written down where my coordinates were, because it's the same ones every time, and then I have to look them up every time, and I haven't had them to hand.
Well, really, shouldn't you know them off by heart? Because they never change.
I know. I'm ashamed of myself. I should have had that sort of literally tattooed on my brain.
Folks, I'm in Birmingham, which is in England, of course, which is the Venice of the United Kingdom. And as always, I'm joined by my no-nonsense mapaholic friend, who is...
Claire Asprey.
Who doesn't know where she is. Well, she doesn't know the coordinates, but she knows where she is on the map. So where are you for people that have never listened to Map Corner before, Claire?
I am in Clapham, Bedfordshire.
Woo-hoo! Not Clapham, the famous Clapham, which has the omnibus in South London.
Not Clapham, now, South London.
Mm-hmm. Map Corner is a podcast dedicated to the love of maps and all things cartophilic, which isn't even a word. But if Peter's your projection, folks, you're in the right place. Now, today we look at our recollections of locations. It's the first time we kind of realise that there was a world outside of our own little town, our own little village, our own little neighbourhood. As children, the first time we discovered a part of the world. That's what we're looking at, our recollections of locations. But before we get into all the good stuff, don't forget to review us on Apple Podcasts, because that's super important. And when you do that, we will give you a roll call in our next episode, which is our Christmas episode. Won't it be, Claire?
It will be, yes. Tinsel will be attached.
Ooh. Smashing. And we have lots of special things lined up here for that show, which we're not going to spoil for you now. But one thing we can say is we're giving you a heads up in terms of calling into the show. So if you've got any specific stories around Christmas and travel, festive travel, anything to do with mapping and Santa Claus, whatever, and the baby Jesus, maybe what you should do, there's no maybe about it, what you can do, what you should do, is go onto mapcorner.space and leave us a voicemail. So we are going to put out that next show just before Christmas. You got no excuse. It won't be Claire haranguing you on the Facebook group, or maybe there'll be a tweet. You know this is going to happen because you've heard it on this podcast.
And also, there'll be a prize.
Oh, gosh, yes, there will. You're doing this broadcast thing very well.
It's almost like now, a fun of you.
So we are going to give away a book which is written by today's interviewee, Mick Ashworth. He's the author of Why North Is Up. We've got a signed copy of that book, which we are going to give away. We're going to ask some kind of smart question. Or maybe, I'll tell you what, Claire, why don't you think about a smart question so folks can actually win the book kind of nowish and get it for Christmas, instead of waiting until the Christmas episode.
Right. Okay.
All right. So I'll just like chunter on for a little bit whilst you think of something really smart, not too hard, because we want as many people to participate in this as possible. All right. And I'll say something like this week's episode, we have calls from Kieran, Ben, Bob and Mia about being wide-eyed about new places. But first, before we have listener calls, we go to our interview with Mick Ashworth, the author of Why North Is Up. And whilst this is running, Claire will think of a fiendishly, not too hard, friendly, cuddly question. You might be able to win Mick's book. So you're up in Scotland, you say?
Yeah, in just outside Glasgow. Quite a lot of our work we do is for Scottish clients, not exclusively, but the main body of our work is for agencies and publishers across Scotland. But we've done work in Europe. We're even doing some maps of St Helena at the moment, which is as far afield as you can get.
So you work with your wife, Jennifer. Do you ever have any mapping arguments? Does she get out of bed one day and say, I'm fed up with Mercator, I'm really into Peters? And you go, oh, my God. Right, yeah. Have there ever been any domestics over mapping?
Not really, no. There is this old argument about, there's a gender issue in terms of whether you can navigate or use maps and so on. I don't particularly buy that, but we don't really have arguments. In fact, there's scope for arguments, but we don't have them because Jennifer does a lot of editorial work and proof checking and so on. So she's finding errors and passing them back to me and very politely saying, well, you got this wrong. But
sounds to me like she's the boss then. You have to hand your homework to her and she corrects
it. Well, it's only the jobs that I choose to sort of pass her away, I suppose.
Why did you form Ashworth Maps in 2008?
We've both worked in mapping and geographic information for all our careers, really. And I'd been working latterly for HarperCollins Publishers, who are also based in Bishopriggs here. They're publishers of the Times Atlas of the World and Collins Atlases and Maps. And I'd worked for them for 12 or 13 years and felt there was an opportunity to do something a bit different. So we had an opportunity to take over a business from somebody we knew who was retiring, and also other opportunities sort of opened up at the same time. So we decided to take the plunge and establish our own small mapping business. Well, the rest is history, I suppose. We've been here about 11 or 12 years now, and it's been going well.
Is the rest history or is the rest geography? I thought we were talking about geography. I'm confused. HarperCollins have been doing the Times atlases, like, it seems like forever and a day. And one of the big imprints of my childhood is actually looking at my dad's version of that atlas from, it was the late 60s. So I think most of Africa was independent. Why have HarperCollins got such a stranglehold with that branded atlas, do you think? What is it about the Times atlases which have been, I think that's kind of the go-to atlas in the UK, isn't it, really?
I think it is, if not the world, to be honest. The authority and the beautiful nature of the cartography have a lot to do with it, but there's a long heritage and a long tradition throughout that product. And Collins Bartholomew can trace their involvement, or HarperCollins. Collins Bartholomew is the geographic division of that, if you like. They trace their involvement in the Times Atlas back through the history of the Bartholomew family, who were a dynasty, if you like, of cartographers in Edinburgh, here in Scotland. And they were involved in the Times Atlas from the turn of the last century, in fact. And Bartholomew got involved directly with the Times to publish the Atlas for them. And when company histories changed and Collett and Bartholomew were sort of taken over by various people and ended up as part of HarperCollins, HarperCollins inherited that huge heritage and tradition that the Times Atlas follows. And they've been very careful, I think, to apply and continue to apply all the principles that were previously applied in terms of accuracy and clarity and tight editorial control, combined now with all the strengths of their own digital data, mean it's still a product that's right up there, really, and still very desirable.
What conventions of Bartholomew, which then morphs into the Times Atlas, brought to the world of cartography, what icons, what shapes, et cetera, draw that kind of lineage, that line, sir?
It's hard to put a finger on it and to actually look at some of the traditions that they have, but they did have a quality of research and editorial skill that's been continued. So for any cartographic editor, it's quite a task to decide what you can actually show and what you can't, more an issue of what you leave off maps and so on. So there's always been a strong editorial tradition to get the content of the maps right. In terms of look, Bartholomew are probably most well-renowned for their depiction of relief. They're largely credited with devising or perfecting the art of what we call hypsometric tints, which are layer colours, which are colouring in the inside of contours to reflect the height of that contour. So there are different ways of representing relief. So they've devised and mastered this method by which you show low ground possibly as green. And then as elevation increases, the colours change through pale browns, creams, pale browns, to darker browns, to purples, to white, and so on, to depict the height. And the idea is that you get an instant picture of which is high ground and which is low ground. And that was quite a cartographic task in the old days when that, before digital production, because the use of colour and so on, the combination of colour to create those layer colours was really quite difficult. But they actually showed it in the Great Paris Show in the 19th century and got a commended award for the look of these maps. So that look, which you can now see probably most famously on the Bartholomew half-inch series of Britain, but also in the Times Atlas as a bit of a hallmark for Bartholomew, and Collins Bartholomew and HarperCollins have been keen to retain that as the main means of representing relief on the Times Atlas. So it's living on through them.
It is totally iconic, really. It's something which you don't really think about as a map head as I am until you see, I don't know, like a map of the Himalayas or of Scotland, and literally you feel like you can feel it. You literally, it feels very tactile that you can actually see the highlands of Scotland as opposed to the coastal areas, and you have a real sense of height.
Yeah, you do, and it does give you some indication of absolute height as well, because the contours have an absolute value. It's a beautiful way of representing relief, and that's why they've stuck with it, I think, and we still use it in Ashworth maps quite a lot.
Are you not tempted to maybe darken a shade for a certain elevation or lighten it, or are you using exactly the same tones?
It would vary with scale, it would vary with the number of layers that you're trying to represent, but the trick of it is to get some sort of meaningful gradation between the layers, so you can't go from one hue to another directly because it's too sharp a break, but the intention is to give some idea of the gradation of the, and so the breaks can't be too sudden, they can't be too extreme, so you're looking at a gentle scaling through different tones of brown or cream or green and so on to make it look fairly gentle. There have been long arguments as to whether it should be darker in the lower areas and lighter in the higher areas, or vice versa. There's been a long argument about that, but then you start getting into the difficulties of legibility of type. So, for example, in the lower altitudes where there are more settlements and more features to be named, there's a problem if you start using very dark hues and dark tones for the layer colours in those levels. So you've got to balance all the cartographic elements together.
So when you talked about arguments, it's not you and Jennifer again, is it? Because I'm trying to find some marital discord here.
You can keep trying, but you won't really find it. No. Jennifer is pretty good at identifying colours, actually. She'll often give maps that I'm doing a once-over for colour. And so she sometimes, would suggest tweaks to colour schemes, for not just for layer colours, but for all the the colouring scheme. So yeah, she'll be involved in that sort of side of things.
So I'm absolutely fascinated by maps. For me, it's more, I must admit, political maps. I love the story of why countries are the shape that they are. So that's led on to an utter fascination with history for me. And for me, political history, geography, etc., all kind of mulch into one. But there is also a history of mapping. Why is up north? Tell us that story.
That's referring to the title of my book, Why North
there
is
you
Up.
Go.
Got to get a mention of that, which was published just recently by the Bodleian Library in Oxford. That book looks at where cartographic conventions came from, what they are, why they've developed the way they have. A lot of people ask, actually, and it doesn't have to be up. There's no up or down to the earth necessarily. Maps can be oriented different ways, and indeed they have done. The maps from Australia that are still have south to the top. Maps in history quite commonly had east to the top. In fact, the word orient, to orient yourself, refers to that, because orient means the east, so the people would orient themselves by placing east at the top of what they were looking at. But as times changed and the importance of navigation in particular arose, and the prominence of the magnetic compass and navigation through the pole star and this sort of thing, and the need to standardize the way nautical charts, for example, were produced by different producers across the world. And finally, because of the most influential map of all time, probably the map by Gerard Mercator, which defined his projection, that had north at the top, and that was crucial to navigation as well. It became a convention from then. It was only in the 19th century that it was really established. And throughout history, it's been a question really of what's important. So when people felt that where the sun rose was important, that direction, which was east, would be put at the top of the map. If a map was oriented in the Roman times, maps may have been oriented with the direction of the emperor's residency at the top of the map, or people would look up to the emperor. So the important thing was in the top of the map. They were looking up to it in both ways, in more ways than one. And so as things changed and how perceptions changed as to what was important for the map, so the convention changed as well. But we're now well established with north at the top. Certainly printed maps. It's another question when it comes to digital maps and sat-nav and so on, where you can press a button and you can orient your map whichever way you want.
Have there been any conventions that have come into the world of mapping in the 20th century, other than, let's say, better printing techniques or the end of the 20th century digital? Are there anything which somebody can physically look on, let's say, a Google map now, on their phone, or a sat-nav map on their car, which is a specific convention which has come about in the last 100 years?
Good question. I think the printing thing that you mentioned is quite important, because printing developments through the last 100 years have meant much better control of colour, much greater range of colour, to be able to use much more precise line work, much more accuracy, if you like, in the production phase of things. There have been conventions derived relating to thematic maps. So over the last 100 years, there's a lot more statistical and thematic mapping that's been created as more information became available, right back to the Enlightenment. As more and more knowledge was acquired, cartographers were challenged in ways to actually represent that. And maps were obviously a key way of representing all this new knowledge that people were getting from exploring the world. So new conventions and use of colour and statistical symbology, so graduated circles and different ways of representing statistics graphically on maps, they developed that way. And the book argues this a little bit, that the newest conventions are more geared to the usage of how maps are used rather than how they look. So you won't see many great variations from established conventions on Google Maps at first glance. But the new convention in that context is that you can type in a search and you can add symbols of your own that detect locations of, I don't know, coffee shops or whatever. So you're becoming a cartographer. So the conventions of search and dropping pins and panning and zooming and all this sort of thing, they've become universal computer age conventions. So they're very much part of maps. So you expect to be able to zoom in and get progressively more detail as you zoom into a map. So those sort of conventions of how the maps behave and how you interact with them are probably more important than changes in the actual conventions of symbology, of how symbols have derived, because maps, when they come down to it, still largely consist of just points, lines and areas treated in different ways.
Obviously, you have a great treasure trove of knowledge when it comes to the world of mapping and geography. You look back at some of the great cartographers of old. Who would be your favourite, sir? Who do you kind of like look up to? Who do you have a little shrine to, a little altar to at home? And you offer a ceremonial kind of burnt map to once, twice a year. Who would that person be?
I don't know whether there'd be a single one, actually. I think Mercator's got to be up there just for the genius of his projection. And I know his projections become more controversial because of how it shows the shape and size of the continents and so on. But the situation he was in when he came up with that and derived this map that served navigation purposes perfectly was just genius, really. And so I think he's got to be way up there. Some of the nicest maps in the book, I think, mm-hmm. are by Lucas Janszoon Wagener, who was a Dutch cartographer in the 16th century, who devised some conventions for nautical charts that still exist on hydrographic charts around the world, actually. But his work, which prior to being a cartographer, he was a seaman, so he knew what was at stake for having safe navigation at sea. But some of the charts that he produced in an atlas of sea charts in the late 16th century are absolutely beautiful in terms of how they're produced. The engraving's fantastic, but the detail of information relevant to seafarers is stunning, really. So he'd be a second one, but I've got to throw in a third one as well. We talked about representation of relief, and I mentioned mm-hmm. hill shading, but nobody can deny, I think, that Edward Imhoff, a Swiss cartographer for the 20th century, was the master of hill shading. So a lot of how Swiss topographic maps and so on look now owe a lot to Imhoff through his artistic and cartographic skills, because some of his hill shaded maps are just some of the most beautiful objects you'll see. So that's three. Okay. You asked me for one, I gave you three.
I did. But that's fine. This is your moment to shine, sir. So you can go away and expand away as much as you want. I'm going to rattle through three maps, and bearing in mind this is a podcast, I need you to describe them so that we can literally see this map in front of us, okay? So let's start with an old classic from 1507. So if I say 1507, do you know which map I'm referring to?
No.
All right. No worries.
I'm not good on dates or history.
Okay.
Is it one I should know? Is it one that's in the book?
Well, okay. It's... Mm-hmm. How about the... I'm going to pronounce it the Waldseemüller World Map, which is the first one to use the name America for the New World.
Oh, yeah.
Describe that map for us.
It's large. I'm not sure the overall size of it, but it's produced in several different bits and pieces. Monochrome, black and white. It's, I think, maybe woodcut. I'm not sure how it was produced. But it was the first map to mention America and was taken as the original a representation of America through some sort, I'm not sure the detailed history of it, but through some sort of mistake of who used the map, who commissioned the map and so on. But America claims that as the first map to name it as a country. And for that reason, I think the Library of Congress in Washington paid a huge amount of money for it quite recently. But in terms of describing what's there, the continents are just about recognizable. I think is at a stage where the continents were becoming just about recognizable, mm-hmm. but also a lot of guesswork in the more far-flung places of the world.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting when you look at that map that very obviously it's Eurocentric in that there's a tremendous amount of detail in Europe and actually North Africa and the what we'd now call the Middle East, but then was called the Near East. So Asia Minor, the Levant, and Persia, etc. And then it kind of thins out the detail when you get to the Urals. But though America is there, North America barely looks recognizable. So you have Cuba as we'd kind of understand it today, and then kind of Florida very close, and then the rest is literally unrecognizable, though the northern coast of South America does look pretty much like how you'd expect. But you're right, Africa, mm-hmm. Asia, Europe are very recognizable, but then the two Americas, yeah. North and South, they're literally almost like placeholders. They're there, yeah, but you don't
they're there. Really... They know they're there, but there's not been any great exploration of them. Yeah, that's right. I think you must have the map in front of you, have you? I don't.
I'm cheating. No, that's all from memory. All from memory.
Yeah, very impressive.
just gonna do one more.
What am I looking for?
Just a Scramble for Africa map. What I've got here is the dates 1852/1898.
There are a lot of maps of Scramble for Africa. One I'm looking at here from the Why North Is Up book is a Bartholomew map by coincidence. Mm-hmm. From that's an 1898 one.
Just describe it, and which countries can we, which modern countries can we recognize from it? What color are the colonial territories, etc., etc.?
Yeah. Well, this comes at a time when Africa was still being explored and so on, and a lot of it reflects what had happened since the Berlin Conference in 1884, when basically Africa was divided up between colonial powers, and they then started to map out their own sort of territories within it and establish them as colonies. So the maps representing the stage of that process. And I would say that the countries that are recognisable are those that are along the coastline, because exploration began on the coast and just headed inland, so that people knew a lot more about the coastline, the ports. So Sierra Leone, Nigeria, other countries in West Africa, Gambia and so on are identifiable. But inland from that, you don't see really much suggestion of Sudan or Central African Republic. They're not there by that stage. So it's a question of successive explorers and successive adventurers heading inland, for whatever reason, good or bad. And as they went, boundaries were drawn by the colonial powers, basically, not quite often without any sort of heed to what was happening on the ground, but limits of colonial influence were established and boundaries started to appear. And those boundaries, on this map, they'll be represented in whatever colour is most appropriate, but the colonial powers do have their own sort of colours. So, yeah. It's the classic cliche that the British Empire, British possessions are shown as pink or red, and other colours are used for, French possessions, Dutch possessions, Italian possessions, and so on. So it'd be good to see animated, actually, to see how knowledge spread from the coastline, where there's a lot of detail and port names and so on, how it progressively spread inland to the continent. But the conventions that you can see, certainly in this example, are the means of representing the boundary lines that were drawn. And so this little colour tint just within the boundaries, a tradition that's existed a long time, and National Geographic are very strong adherents to that sort of method of depicting a boundary. A lot of other publishers use solid colour, different colours for filling in countries. But it does highlight the number of boundaries that were established. And again, it'd be interesting to compare the boundaries as they looked then and how they look now, because those boundaries have been such a source of geopolitical conflict since they were drawn.
Absolutely. And you put your finger on it, that when that Scramble for Africa kind of starts with that Berlin Conference, and they were just lines on a map, weren't they? The lines on a map, which started from some notion of colonial holdings, which were coastal, and then they just kind of went inland. And it's one of the reasons why Africa has suffered some of the economic and political confusion that it has post-independence of those states, which starts in the 50s and the 60s, because traditional communities have been cleaved apart and or joined together with other societies, which historically they were not part of. You know, so we have weird constructs of countries.
Yeah, we do. But I think people underestimate just what's involved in actually drawing a boundary on a map. If you're publishing a printed map, you do literally have to draw the line somewhere. And interestingly, Google, maybe since overtaken by events, but certainly some time ago, when you could access Google in China, I'm not sure you can now, if you could and look at Chinese users of Google Maps would see the world from a Chinese point of view. So it would be the way that China believed the boundaries should be. So Taiwan would be part of China. But if you accessed Google Maps from India, you'll see a completely different picture. Publishers lay their reputations on the ground sometimes as to how they represent boundaries because they're not going to please everybody all the time. And the spill out of that in the Middle East is a classic example where, yeah, like you say, the colonial powers drew fairly random lines that suited them, nice straight lines across the Middle East and divided them between countries. But subsequently, the amount of grief that that's caused has been great. So the book, the Why North Is Up book, has a section on boundaries and place names, which are similarly contentious about how you represent place names. So ways of representing these geopolitical situations have had to be devised and have to be used very, very carefully by cartographers, I'd say.
Just as we start to wrap up, just a quick note. If people want to see an animated map of the Scramble for Africa, because you did kind of say you'd like to see an animated one, there is actually one on YouTube. So if you type in the Scramble for Africa every month,
I've seen similar things for other, for like the whole of history, but not for Scramble for Africa. That'd be quite interesting.
No, it is absolutely fascinating. So, sir, you've only come on this show to peddle your book. You're not interested.
I've come on to talk about labs.
How long did it take for you to put together the book? And what was the driving impetus for you and Jennifer to put the thing together?
Well, the impetus came from being invited to consider writing it, actually. The Bodleian Library is one of the major libraries in Europe, if not the world, really, down in Oxford. And they have an amazing map collection. And they've got an exhibition on at the moment, Talking Maps. I think it's on until next April. And they they were publishing books directly related to that exhibition, but they had an idea to produce a map just for the layman of just what really lies behind mapping and what cartographers really get into and what they're really looking at when they look at maps. So they threw this idea at me, I think largely because I've been a practitioner of this. I was editor of the Times Atlas of the World for 10 or 12 years or so. So the practice of it is where I come from. So I don't know an awful lot about the history things, but I know the practical side of applying these sort of conventions. But they thought it'd be interesting to just explore what lies behind why maps look like they look now. And so I considered that must have been about 2 years ago. And so I thought it was a good way to almost look back over my time as a cartographer the last 30, 40 years to just help people understand exactly what I've been trying to do all that career. So we look at map projections and grids and scale, all those sort of concepts behind maps, but also on symbols, why line symbols, how line symbols are used, point symbols, area symbols, boundaries, names, just short chapters on each of these aspects of maps so that people will hopefully just understand a bit more about what they're looking at when they look at a map. Once we decided the way forward and I'd proposed a sort of structure for the book, it probably took about a year to put together. It was published about a month ago.
I'm presuming that you are fat on the royalties of your book, sir. That it's
not yet. Not unless you've heard something I haven't heard. I don't know. I don't know yet. I'm not too uptight about that. I'm giving some talks about it. I like talking about it, and I think it's just great just engaging with people, because basically what I'm doing is a job as a cartographer. It's a job that people, when you tell them what you do, they say, "Wow, that's great." I really like maps, and people engage with you straight away. So I just enjoy talking about something that a lot of people like to hear about, really.
That is a perfect end, sir. Perfect end. Thank you for coming on to Map Corner. And I'm presuming that all good bookshops have your book.
Yeah.
Listen, Mick, thank you for coming on to Map Corner. Can we have you back on again sometime soon? Because you were pretty good.
Thank you. Yeah, anytime. If you've got something that specific that you think I can contribute to, then yeah, sure. Unless the royalties have come in so much that I've totally retired.
Well, I'm somewhat conflicted now, because I want the sales of the book to do really well, but also I want you to come back again. So,
all right,
let's hope for middling sales then.
Yeah, okay. No, I'd be glad to come back anytime.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks, Royfield.
utterly fascinating bloke to talk to, and just bloody nice. And really, one of the kind of like things that I took away from that was that he's had a little hand in so many of the atlases that we all love, and atlases that have been a pivotal part of me falling in love with the whole world of mapping. So it was utter pleasure to speak to Mick. Claire, have you thought of how and why, what's the mechanism we should use to give away this wonderful book that we've got from Mick?
Well, given that we're in the business of trying to drum up some more reviews, I think we should award it to the best review that's come in by, the 10th of December, something like that.
Sounds like an eminently smart solution to our thorny problem of how we're going to give away this bloody excellent book. So well done, you. Folks, just before we go on to the audio postcard from our Claire, we need to remind you that you can go on to SpeakPipe on mapcorner.space. Funny URL, but that's actually where our website sits. And you can use SpeakPipe to get your questions into us, because what we are developing here is a community of mapperaholic mapophiles who love this schnizzle. And the way of us creating that is by hearing your voice on this podcast. This is your podcast as much as it is ours. So go on to mapcorner.space, hit the little SpeakPipe button. Works from your phone, works from your laptop, and let's get your questions in and your observations into us. And before I forget, you know the great thing about doing a podcast in November, Claire? Do you know what it is?
That you get to sit somewhere warm and cosy and don't have to do it on location?
No, that's not where I was going. No, that could well be the case. The wonderful thing is that if you have merch in your podcasting shop, which you can access by going onto mapcorner.space, you can say to people that, why don't you go on there and get a Map Corner mug for your loved one for Christmas?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Add it to your gift list. Get people to buy it for you if you're a listener.
Absolutely. So there you go. Claire has given you the hard sell, right? So now why don't you go onto mapcorner.space, hit the shop little button, get yourself one of our wonderful mapper mugs, and give it to your loved one for Christmas, or just get it for yourself. And they're awesome. They hold hot liquid or even cold liquid. They hold it, a treat. You won't burn your hands because they've got a nice handle and they look rather smart. Now, that's me talking about stuff you can buy. Now, here's our Claire talking about her part of her holiday down under.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, this is Claire with my postcard from tropical North Queensland. And I wanted to talk about what can be achieved now with GPS, because I just went on the Skyrail which goes over the top of the rainforest from just outside Cairns up to Crandon in the hills. And it was amazing to be on a, well, cable car above the rainforest, above the Barron River. Saw crocodiles in the river. It's quite exciting. And it's another amazing engineering achievement. I seem to be focusing on amazing engineering achievements. But maybe engineering is driven by topography. And that's because, you know, humans are trying to find ways of overcoming the limitations of landscape. A lot of basic engineering is about bridges and waterways and so on and so forth. So, you know, that's where human endeavour sits, I guess. What I thought was really interesting about the Skyrail was that just as we pulled up in our coach to the base station, the driver said, oh, don't forget to load up the Skyrail app when you get into the station. There's free Wi-Fi all through the Skyrail stations, and they encourage you to do it. And so I did. And what an amazing little piece of kit, because it uses GPS to track which cable car you're in and where you get to. And as soon as you hit a certain point on the journey, it launches into a little audio narration about something that you're going over or something that you can see. And it tells you which way to look and what you know what's around. And it's a really simple idea, but it just shows how, you know, GPS that everyone carries with them these days can be part of something that really enhances an experience. And GPS was really important to the building of Skyrail because a lot of it was done by helicopter, because they just brought stuff in over the top of the rainforest with these big Russian helicopters. They had no roads. People had to hike to the stations where they built all the towers for the cable car. It was like 30 odd towers. The thing runs for nearly 5 miles and with 3 stations along the way. And a lot of the supplies were delivered using GPS because you couldn't see over the rainforest canopy where you were. And now the GPS is used for the tourists to get the most out of it. And it just shows you the value of that kind of technology. So that was great. I highly recommend it.
So in terms of topography and climate, how different was Perth from Cairns? Because I understand that Perth is southwest of Australia, then Cairns is far up on the east northern side, up in the pointy bit.
Absolutely,
where
yeah.
It all gets a little bit kind of rainforesty.
It
so
was really interesting.
An idea
yeah.
How different. Yeah.
So we were there in April, so that was just sort of going into autumn in the southern hemisphere, and so it had been the end of the summer, and everything was very parched and brown in Perth, and then Cairns was just unbelievably lush. It's a rainforest area. It was sort of tropical. You had sugar cane growing in the fields and dense kind of green hills of rainforest in the background. So it felt really, really different. It's a bit like when you've been somewhere hot and sunny and you come back to the UK and it suddenly looks amazingly green. Similar sort of feeling. And really, really different. That was just quite refreshing, really, after having been in a kind of quite a parched looking place. That was lovely.
So send out a question for somebody who knows about meteorology and how geography affects meteorology, because I know that Australasia, maybe you should call it in this context, is by far the driest continent. And there's all these stories in the 19th century of explorers going into the hinterland of Australia to find the lake at the heart of the continent, because every other continent there is a large body of water in the middle. And it was a fool's errand. There is no lake.
No.
But I don't know enough about meteorology and how geography affects it, to understand the reason why the interior of Australia is just so barren and dry. And it really is just the coastal fringes, isn't it, which are truly suitable for human inhabitation. So if you know that stuff, please call in and speak pipe and let us know, why is Australia so different from Africa or South America, etc.? Why is it that it just doesn't rain generally in the centre of that continent? Why is it so dry?
Yeah, because I've left my globe downstairs, but I'm trying to think in what kind of how far from the pole is it compared to like what things are on the North Pole, and you know, what would the comparable be to where it is in terms of latitude, longitude. Anyway,
somebody will know. Somebody listening Absolutely. Will know. And if you don't know, hazard a good guess, please, and sound knowledgeable. So we can at least, you know, and you'll sweep us along with your theory anyway. Now, before we go on to your map fact of the month, I need to give a little bit of a shout out, because we're going to be joined as of the next episode, Claire, by Ben Jacobs, who has called in once or twice before. He's a man of a big beard and a great urban planning intellect. And he's going to do a little slot, a thingette, on each episode where he's going to talk about how cities work and how they're developed from but unlike you and me, he's an actual expert, so he knows what he's talking about. So there'll be hushed silence when Ben comes on the mic.
Yeah, love a planner.
So I'm just warning you. Exactly. Something that I can actually never be, a planner. So as of next episode, we will have the Ben Jacobs slot, and he'll be doing his thing. So give him a warm welcome and round of applause, folks, as of the Christmas episode when he comes on mic. But now it's time for Claire's map fact of the month.
Oh, well, this is one that I've basically lifted slightly, if I'm honest, from somewhere else. But
Nick.
Yeah. It's about how magnetic north is moving faster than any time in human history, or at least when we've recorded it, presumably. I'm guessing for most of human history, we didn't have the technology to understand where magnetic north was and whether it was moving. But, you know, so when we talk about human history, we're probably talking about a comparatively short span of all human history. But, basically, what it means is that people's compasses are pointing to different places now than they were, you know, a year or two ago. And it's moving about 50 kilometres a year right now. That's quite substantial. Like, that's putting you in a complete...
50 kilometres a year?
Absolutely. It's moving around a heck of a lot, and it's getting faster. So there's a suggestion that that might mean that the kind of poles are changing direction or something. I don't know. Anyway, it's to do with the molten core of the Earth and the magneticism of it. I'm not an expert, but I find this fascinating, because with so many things in terms of maps and geography and geology, really, I mean, geology is one of these things that feels like things are so set in stone, but actually geology and geological time tells us how things have really changed, you know, very substantially over, you know, very, very many thousands and millions of years. And that the Earth is not static. But, you know, this is something that feels a lot more kind of fast moving than some of that very, very geological time stuff. It just, you know, the idea that your magnetic compass points in a different place than it did a year or two ago. And maps have to adjust, so you have to well, people who are doing it properly with, you know, orienteering and stuff have to know how different magnetic north is compared to the magnetic north where it was on the map when the map was printed. So there's a whole load of information out there for people who need to know, because they're using paper maps printed at a particular time compared to, you know, where the magnetic north is now. Which must be quite hard work, I think, just to recalculate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So is it moving in a predictable fashion, though, or is it just random?
I saw a map somewhere, I can't see it now, but I remember seeing a map which sort of tracked the path of it, and it was sort of vaguely elliptical. I mean, I think people are obviously, we're tracking it, so we know roughly where it is. And so we're doing some predictions of where it will get to. It's, you know, it's already moved from the top of Canada to the top, sort of nearly on to Russia. So, you know, that's quite a shift.
And why is it magnetic north that we're concerned about? Is there a magnetic south, east or west?
Oh, good point. I would assume that there are, but I mean, presumably that's why north is up, because that's the one we've been paying attention to. Perhaps it's easier because we have far more population nearer the North Pole than we have nearer the South Pole. So our and there's far more land mass near the North Pole than the South Pole. So maybe that our ability to monitor it is better. You know, this is at the point where you find that I am absolutely not an expert. I just thought it was interesting.
Bloody hell. Right. On that note, remember, folks, if you know more about this stuff than us, please ring in.
Call us in and tell us where we got it wrong.
Yeah, and just educate not only us, but the other few thousand listeners of these podcasts that we do have, because that's what we're trying to foster, a community, and also a little bit of knowledge, because we don't know what we're talking about half the time. But here's some people who, if they don't know what they're talking about, at least have some great recollections about locations. And here is Kieran.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Kieran. And the first trip I remember is going to Jamaica with my parents in 1986. Now, looking back, I think the reason I remember it is because my dad actually filmed the trip with his camera. And that video has been around for my whole life. So I think that's actually why I remember. But anyway, here's some of the things I do remember. I remember us going on a glass bottom boat. I remember that. I remember my grandmother had a dog. My grandmother in Jamaica, she had a dog at the time, and it was like a Jack Russell or something like that. And I used to really enjoy playing with that dog. And I think I used to ride that dog like a horse. Bearing in mind, I would have been like 3 or 4 years old at the time. I remember that. I remember going to Duns River Falls. And I remember driving across through Jamaica, and I also remember doing some touristy stuff as well, and going to different places and seeing people who told us about the history of Jamaica and Bob Marley, things like that. These are some things that I remember.
Thank you for that, Kieran. And I think Kieran raises one really interesting point, something that chimes with me, Claire, is that recollections when we're very small really are reinforced by any photographs or if you shot.
I was about to say the exact same thing. When I was young, quite young, we went to Spain one or two times on like package holidays, you know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, when, you know, it was becoming kind of a thing to do. And I look back and I cannot remember anything about like the aeroplanes or barely any of the journey. I can remember sort of the excitement of starting out early in the morning to go to the airport. I can't actually remember any parts of the journeys at all, which you'd think for a sort of, you know, 6-year-old or whatever would be quite a big thing to do. And it's all completely gone, but I can picture, I can have some specific memories of, you know, being in the pool. I remember specifically the time when I got sunstroke and I got very peculiar kind of hallucinogenic dreams. And I can remember things about like where we've got photos and stuff. And I can remember the things that we've got photos of, especially because obviously they're the things that were reinforced. But, you know, I can remember other things as well. But I remember nothing at all about the travel. I don't know whether we get a coach transfer when we got there. I don't know, whatever. I literally can't remember any of that at all. And I didn't fly for ages after that until I was about 18 and we went to Portugal. I had a really rough flight and I hated it. It took me a while to get over my fear of flying again after that. But I don't remember being scared of flying when I was a kid. And I don't remember anything about it. So it's literally, we just got no photos of that bit of the journey. So it hasn't stayed in my head.
The first journey that I remember, a trip, holiday, was to Southend-on-Sea. And I remember fragmentary things. And the strange thing is that I do remember bits of the journey. I suppose because I was just so excited. We're going to the seaside. And this is about 1972, 73. So it's just, I'm just old enough for my memories to be ordered. Mm-hmm. But I remember we drove down the motorway and it was really exciting to be on the motorway. And at some point, my mum must have been looking at a paper map because my dad didn't know where Southend was per se. So we needed a paper map. And I remember the motorway was blue. I remember that. And I remember we stopped off at a service station. It was like all my Christmases had come at once. We were stopping off at a service station and I can't remember what we ate, but I remember there was a yellow Tonka toy, a digger. And I said to my dad, please, can I have that? Please, can I have that? And he said, yes. And then I remember being on this beach. And this is where the whole photograph thing comes in. I remember this lovely, it looked like Captain Birdseye, white beard, white graying hair, captain's hat, and was even wearing like a blue, like seafaring blazer, double-breasted blazer. And the only reason why I have that level of detail is because we have a picture of him. I remember talking to him, but this is obviously reinforced by the picture in the family album. And I said that I like to draw. And he gave me a piece of paper and a pen and I drew something. But I would not be able to remember the detail of how this gentleman looked, what he was wearing, if it wasn't for the fact it's been reinforced year after year whenever I looked at this kind of family album. But he looked exactly like Captain Birdseye. Mm. And I remember us having this interaction on this pebbly beach at Southend-on-Sea. So, and then all these kind of family myths kind of grow up, don't they, around kind of holidays. This person did this and then you did that, et cetera, et cetera. And the other thing that I remember is watching my dad shave. And I think, like, then he went out the bathroom and I took up his razor and started to shave and cut my face. So in terms of the holiday and eating ice creams or what the weather was like, I couldn't tell you. But, you know, at the age of, what was I, like three at the time, you know, these fragmentary little bits of recollections and stuff. And I couldn't tell you at all anything about Southend. I know we drove there, but couldn't tell you, you know, what Southend looked like at all. You know.
No, I can especially remember a little sort of woolen shoulder shawl that myself and my sister got when we were in Spain and that we're wearing in one of the photos. And I can remember more about what it was like to wear that little shawl than like quite a lot else that we ever did on holiday.
Well, you know what? Let's hold all conversations about shoulder shawls and let's hear what Ben Jacobs has got to say about his recollections.
Hello, Roy Field and Claire. This is Benjamin Jacobs. You guys asked about our first big trip that we remember. I don't remember exactly how old I was. I think I was five or six. And we went to Nova Scotia. It's probably my favorite trip that I've been on, and it certainly instilled a love of travel in me. We left from New Jersey, where I lived at the time. We drove up to Bar Harbor and Acadia National Park, which the big thing I remember about the entire trip was all the different colors of granite that, like, there was pink granites and black granites and all these different colors of stone. It was very beautiful, especially when you factor in the wave action and everything, creating all these smooth stones and all these different colors. And Acadia is pretty much as close to paradise as I can conceive of. It's nice and cool, good views, lots of pretty things to look at, nature, and everything smells wonderful and all that stuff. And then Well, so then from there, from Bar Harbor, we got on an auto ferry, which was also kind of like a cruise ship at the time. And we, the big thing about that was that my sister ordered a lobster, and she was like 2 or 3. And the waiter was looking at my parents like, "Are you sure?" This thing comes out and it's as big as she is. And long story short, she ate the whole thing. And that was just the beginning of the trip. We had a great time. Nova Scotia is absolutely beautiful. There are some amazing hotels, but I'm out of time. So thanks very much.
Do you know what I love most about that? Is that What's you that? Notice the different kinds of granite.
Well, you know what? That's the reason why Ben is the man that he is and has actually got a job in this field, and we are just enthusiastic amateurs. What 12-year-old is looking at rocks and noticing them?
I know. It's brilliant.
The other thing which I kind of pulled out of that was maybe a little bit more universal that the rest of us can connect to, is that generally the first or the second time that we travel, it is idyllic. It is paradise. Everything about it is magical. And as you kind of said earlier on, the journey is an integral part. It isn't just getting there. It's, you know, being a child and being wide-eyed and maybe getting up really early in the morning to travel all the way to the airport. And that is just so exciting. And then to go into the cathedral of travel, you know, the airport, etc., is for a 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old as exciting as actually even landing type of thing.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that led quite well into Bob's call, as it happens.
Oh, all right then. Look at you, slick. Let's move on to Bob then.
Hi. I'm just remembering the journeys I had with my mum and dad going to holidays many years ago, probably back into 55 or something like that, when I was 7. When we went to Somerset quite a lot and the Wirral in Cheshire, all from Bedford. And the journeys were so long. And my dad's old Morris 8 that went almost 40 miles an hour sometimes. And the places we visited on the way, I think every journey was accompanied by several stops, sometimes in a pub where we had a Vimto and a packet of crisps. With salt in the packet outside, but my great memories are sitting for ages and ages and ages in the back of this car, and who can see the sea first was the big moment of the journey. But the journey itself seemed to be the max of the holiday almost, because the further you went, you know, the better the place was going to be, the more anticipation it was going to be. And poor mum was sat in the passenger seat, just trying to read a map, and dad was ignoring her all the time. Lovely memories.
Anything you want to? Any personal anecdotes you want to?
Oh, well, yeah. Full disclosure. Bob is my dad, and I looked up his national day, mm-hmm. which is the Central African Republic. So there you go. I can add to that. You've got to remember, growing up in Bedford, we're about as far from the sea as it's possible to get in the UK, and like, no one's that far from the sea in the UK. But it's about as far as you can possibly get where we are. And the first to see the sea. I saw the sea. I'm sure I'm not the only child who grew up with that particular enthusiastic cry. And back in the day, you know, roads were a lot longer and slower. And so you did stop off. And in a motorway, you don't get to see any of that, you know. But, you know, even... You know, sort of 30 years ago, you had to travel through so many more places. We take for granted now that we generally bypass certainly most major towns and a lot of villages as well. But, you know, we don't have to go that far back to think that actually we used to have to travel right through the middle often of some of the places that were on the way. Mm. And, you know, so in some ways it was more interesting. You got to see more different places. It's a lot less diverse when you just sit on a motorway system all the time. So we sort of lost some of the character of travel, I think. But, you know, it did take a heck of a long time to literally go through everywhere. So there you go.
Hi there, Royfield, Claire, and all map cornerers around the world. This is Mia in Newcastle. Just to give you a little credential, couldn't find any country anywhere close to my birthday, so my adopted birthday is 13.1339 degrees south and 27.8493 degrees east, which makes me Zambia. I remember one of my first trips abroad was when I was 6 years old with my family to Lloret de Mar in the Costa Brava in Spain, and we went for New Year. Sounds very grand. It was one of the few holidays we ever had, and I just remember a terribly cold place with stony beaches and celebrating New Year. I remember my dad writing down 1971 or 1972, whatever it was, and then 5 minutes later after midnight writing down the following year. And it's a great memory. So although I didn't have that fond memories of the stony beaches hurting my feet, I do remember Lloret de Mar with fondness there. However, I always thought it was North Spain until earlier this year when I went to Barcelona and realised it was nearby there. Fantastic podcast and great stuff. Thank you ever so much. Take care now. Bye.
Oh, bye, Mia.
Remind us about the reasons why you ended up in Spain.
I ended up in Andalusia because I was a part-time flamenco dancer at the time. And inside my head, I'm dancing every day. I don't dance a lot these days, but I did a little Sevillanas in the kitchen this morning. So, you know, I never stop, really.
Isn't that lots of stamping and then, like, holding the hem in your skirt up?
There's some of that, yes. I have to admit, swooshing the skirt around is half the fun.
Well, on a future episode, you're going to have to give us the history of flamenco. And where exactly it comes from in the great nation of Spain, and we can map out its evolution.
Yeah, yeah. Also. Started in India as Katak.
I said it in a future episode, Claire.
Yeah, yeah. I'll do some more research. I'll do some more homework, and I'll do a session later.
Smashing. All right. So we're almost at the point where we can start to wind things up. So why don't you do that by telling us all about Facebook and the Twitters?
Okay, right. I'm going to take it all as a whole this time because we've had some things that have been posted on both Facebook and Twitter, and there's a bit of overlap. So some of the things that have really caught my eye, we've obviously just come through the back end of October, and we've had some interesting stuff posted to the Twitter by @NissyPoke73 around what's the most favourite Halloween candy across America. So it's mapped across different types of candy that people like in different states. I've just had to buy an advent calendar for my daughter full of Reese's something or other peanutty mm-hmm. things. Anyway, mm-hmm. clearly it's a thing over here as well. And and then also we had a wonderful map posted on the Facebook group, which was a sort of live update about where to see the best fall colours across Pennsylvania for parks, I think. So yeah, it's another autumnal sort of suggestion, which you know, it's an ambition of many people, isn't it, to go and see the fall. And I think it would be gorgeous, but if we can track it on the map, that's again something that people like to do as a sort of, if they can't get there, they can track it on a map, which is part of the joy of maps. Have you seen some good falls in North America or Canada?
You know, Canadians always say that in Canada there are four seasons. And I would say that there are three seasons in Canada. There is summer, which is glorious. It's super hot. Then there is autumn or fall, which can be spectacularly red and golden. You know, it's a cliche, but it is spectacular. And then there's winter. I don't think there's any such thing as spring. It just seems to go from tundra-like weather to all of a sudden the sun starts shining. Whereas I'm always struck in the UK that we do have a spring. You know, we have April showers and then there is flowers bud and they bloom, you know, sort of thing. Whereas over there, it just seems to be, you just go from, oh my God, it's minus X to, oh my God, I'm sweating. So, but I'm the wrong person to talk about fall or autumn because I just like summer. It's the reason why I've kind of relocated myself to Northern California, because they will tell you they have an autumn, but they don't. Leaves barely fall off trees. Every day is T-shirt weather, and that's just the way I like it. So to answer to your question, I suppose I have, but I don't like them much.
Fair enough. So some of the other fun things that have posted, I think I'd give a shout out to Richard McKenzie, who on the Facebook group shared that he has a real fascination with Berlin and has posted photos of his various maps of Berlin. And there's some really interesting maps of Berlin, actually, because of the kind of partition of that city. And we've obviously seen a lot of information about that recently because the wall came down 30 years ago, about last week. As we record, and you know, so the way that that played out in terms of people's maps as well as people's lives is interesting, and I love it when people from the group just share photos of, hey, look, I've got this really cool map and this is what it's like. So you know, I encourage that absolutely. More people are doing that, well, that would be great. We had a really interesting map posted by Mark Everdon on the Facebook group, which showed you all the different traditional soups of Europe. And I think, again, this sort of be feeding in. I don't even know I'm doing it. we could do another sort of food-themed map corner, because there were some really great maps of kind of the foods of different nations and the foods of different continents. And I thought that one was quite fun. So it shows what, you know, the traditions of different parts of the continent. We've had some maps posted both on Twitter and Facebook. I think you did the one on Facebook, which was sort of the first word of different national anthems. I've seen a number of these maps circulating recently, and there's one for Europe. I've seen one for, I think, Asia. And, you know, just to give you a sense of, you know, how do you open a national anthem? There's some really interesting sort of highlights on those. That's worth having a look. Friend of the show, Ken McDonald, posted quite a long article actually from The New Yorker about the catacombs of Paris and the world that lives underneath the city. And I have to say, I read it through, and it's incredibly claustrophobic. I don't think I would have the guts to go down into the catacombs for long stretches at a time. It sounds just awful, but I guess the people who like caving and going down into caves and tunnels underground for, you know, days on end and having parties down there, it does something for them, but I'm not sure it's my particular bag. I don't know. How do you feel about being underground?
I don't mind being underground at all. If it's kind of in the middle of a city, yeah, great. I love a metro system. I love a subway. But I went to, in the great state of Arizona, I went to just outside of Tucson about 2-3 years ago, and they have the most extensive kind of collection of caves with stalagmites and stalagmites. And it was it's like a cathedral, but underground. Utterly amazing, where the water has just continued to trickle for tens of thousands of years and just created this wonderland of just like colours and just space. And you just wouldn't believe how cavernous it was. And I forget how far you're underground, but it had its own kind of like, you know, temperature and little microclimate in there and stuff. But then just to see, I forget which are stalagmites and stalactites, you know, which go up and which go down.
Tites hang from the ceiling like tites, and mites grow up from the ground.
Uh-huh. But here, and they're formed by the little droplets, aren't they, of water. It's actually how they've, and they've joined. It was just amazing. So you had these, like, poles just, like, in the middle of these caves, and it was just utterly, utterly, utterly beautiful. And as I've said before on this podcast, geology and the natural world isn't my first love for the reason why I love maps. But holy camole, did I just like say, you know, that the natural world can be such a thing of awe-inspiring beauty. And it was all underground.
Now you're making me remember a very early trip when I was a kid and went to Cheddar Gorge and the caves at Cheddar in Somerset, I want to say. There you go. But yeah, so caves are pretty cool, actually. But the catacombs of Paris sound like they're pretty tight in places, and it's that claustrophobic feeling. But our Ken has been down in the catacombs and also has done a little bit of exploring of storm sewers back in the USA. So he's very much our kind of group adventurer. So well done, Ken.
You got anything else?
Okay, so just one quick one that I posted, which I recommend, which is a lot of fun, which is where you can look up your location of where you are or anywhere in the world that you want to look for, I guess, and it will show you where it was in Pangaea when all of the continents were one. And I thought that was quite a lot of fun. It shows you where it was over geological time. It's been a bit of a theme this week, hasn't it, the geological time. So, yeah, that was a lot of fun. And then I'm going to come finally to my map of the month. And my map of the month is it was posted both on Twitter and on Facebook, actually, and it's a map from World War II, which has been around on the social media, which was around a map that was sort of given out to Polish airmen who worked with the RAF and gave them sort of like a phonetic map of how to pronounce places on in Britain. Well, as the bit that I see is mainly sort of just sort of bits of the East Coast. So it's got Southend-on-Sea, as it happens, to remember your first holidays. So, yes, it shows you if you're a Polish speaker, how would you say Southend-on-Sea or Bishop Stortford or Maidstone or places like that? It looks... Yeah, it's fun because it's sort of familiar but foreign, and it shows you, you know, places where, you know, if you know what the original place names are, you can just about work it out. But it's really not obvious to start with, and some of them really feel incredibly foreign looking. What their version of what Colchester is quite peculiar, to be honest. I'm not quite sure how they work the pronunciation on that. But so that was clearly very popular on both the Twitter and the Facebook group. And I think it's always fun to see a map which shows you the familiar but in an unfamiliar way. And this very much does that.
So are we just about done, Arclair?
We are. Don't forget, though, to call us in about things about Christmas, Christmas maps, Christmas travel. Where is Santa? Who thinks they know where Santa lives? That would be an interesting one because... You know, there are different theories for that.
Mm. You know, Santa is like travelling all across the world, right?
Yeah.
Which country is the origin of his passport, do you reckon? Or should we be saving this question actually for that Christmas show, I suppose?
Oh, we really should. I'm not sure. I wasn't aware that he passes through passport control in any location. That could really slow him down.
Yeah, he would if he goes into US immigration. It definitely would slow him down, I tell you. But anyway, let's talk of Santa and Christmas mapping on next month's episode. Don't forget, folks, go on to SpeakPipe, which is on mapcorner.space, to give us your Christmas stories and how it relates to the world of mapping. Also, go on to mapcorner.space and you can get yourself, just in time for Christmas, a nice Map Corner mug. And the person who writes the best review on Apple iTunes, Apple Podcasts, will actually win a copy of Why Is North Up, which is a most excellent book. So if you do that now, you might get yourself a very early Christmas present, courtesy of Ashworth Books and Map Corner. Have we just about done and said everything
we have? We need to do. It's time to fold up our maps.
Hey, look at you. Well done.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.